You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Mainly my role has been dealing with media inquiries, public speaking engagements, and more of the outward-facing work that's needed at this kind of time, as well as dealing with the government engagement and meeting with various people in government. Also have been involved in writing our submission for the gun law reform and presenting to the select committee. So generally, yeah, my role has been very outward focused, while there are others that are working within the community and in Christchurch.
What is happening internally at the moment with the Islamic Women's Council, and what is it that your role is generally as an organisation, but what's happening right now?
So what's happening right now is that we are looking to get some expertise from Canada of people who have dealt with 911 and, you know, the tragedy in Quebec, and to come here and provide some expert advice and training and support for community leaders. We are continuing to engage with government in terms of what the community in Christchurch is facing on the ground, and some issues with especially around children. So, yep, we're working on that. Yeah, those are the main things for now.
But because generally the Islamic Women's Council has a broader role, right?
Generally, yes, we do. We're a volunteer organisation with not much funding, so we do what we can in terms of, we hold an annual conference for Muslim women. We have held youth camps. We had one just at the end of last year. We have international speakers that we arrange to go around the country. We organise workshops. We were running an international student support program, and yeah, generally then the media engagement and government engagement, and often just getting calls from women that are seeking support and trying to connect them with the support that they need.
And over the past 5 years, that government engagement regarding trying to bring attention to the threat of Islamophobia that these communities are facing. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So we felt like we were seeing a real increase in negativity, and particularly around the time with the rise of ISIS, with social media becoming much more of a platform for spreading hateful messages. And also, you know, with the growth of our community, we were finding that our leadership team was struggling with the demand around social issues that needed much more in-depth investment and resourcing than what we had the ability to provide. And also, as an organisation, we couldn't access lotteries funding because it's gambling money. And we found that a lot of NGOs started out with using lotteries money to establish themselves, and we just didn't have access to that. So that's why we wrote a report to government, and then we continued to engage at various levels to try and raise awareness and ask for support around a wide level of programming to deal with, you know, the growing level of hatred and the impact that we were seeing that it was having on our community.
That, with the point about the lotteries money, and just the, even coming back to today and the way that there was such a delay in returning the bodies to the family, what I've sort of seen is there's this inability, kind of, or to an extent, from New Zealand to actually deal with different practices. Is that something that you've noticed?
I do feel like there was a lot of resources put into releasing the bodies, and I understand they would have had to go through various processes around identification and so on. But still, it would have been good, because I know the families were feeling a lot of stress around the fact that their bodies couldn't be released sooner. And for us, we tend to hold funerals the same day or the next day, We don't hold the bodies, and we tend not to wait for people to travel because people can pray where they are. And the more important thing is to get the funeral and get the body buried as soon as possible. So I don't know where the government could have done more in that regard, those questions that they would have to be asked. But generally, yeah, I think that the people we were talking to didn't appreciate the urgency and the level of the need. And I don't know that they took it as seriously as we needed them to.
And that sort of seems to be the case over the past 5 years, right? So there was this element of the issues that you and your and the Islamic Women's Council were raising, and other groups as well, and they weren't being taken seriously.
And I think one of the issues is that the people that were in positions of making decisions didn't have that lived experience, and that always helps when you're trying to deal with the issue to have people in the room when you're making the big decisions that have lived experience of what is being talked about, because then they can speak to that and iron out any misconceptions or work on areas of resistance. And that's, I think, a major thing that we have to look at, certainly through the public service, but also through civil society, NGOs and private enterprise as well.
The attacks occurring, the fact that that they happened, is very much a symbol of our failure. I think I've sort of, that's the way I see it, is that there's been a failure in many levels, and that again, you like you say, in terms of the representation, not having people in those positions who understand that threat and are able to make decisions because of it. I had also questioned whether it was also naivety on some groups that didn't consider the alt-right or far-right extremism as a real threat, but also discrimination. Would you say it was also those things?
I think there was this kind of complacency that New Zealand was safe from those kinds of things because of the physical distance and because we hadn't had anything like that happen here. So really, yeah, we'll have to wait to see what comes out with the Royal Commission of Inquiry, I think, because that will hopefully shed a light on what the thinking was, what actions were or weren't taken, and why that was the case, and where the funding was put in and where it wasn't. All those sort of issues need to be brought to light so that we can make sure that we have the right kind of focus as we move forward.
And so what would that look like? What does accountability look like to you?
I think it looks like transparency. It looks like making sure that we have an understanding of what the processes were, what the blocks were, what the thinking was, so that we can then ensure that it doesn't happen again. I mean, that's the main thing, is how do we make sure that not just our community, but marginalised communities have their issues addressed in a meaningful way that makes a difference to their lives.
And in terms of addressing this not only at a governmental level, but on a ground level, how is it that the everyday person can engage, you know, with what's quite clearly a widespread issue, like you say, not only the Muslim community but other marginalised communities? How do we sort of deal with that?
I think there's a lot of upskilling that needs to occur. I think in terms of people that are working on the ground and frontline services, there needs to be a lot of training of staff and a lot more listening to and thinking about what people who are reporting that they have barriers or they're feeling like they're not getting the service that they need, really listening into that and thinking about how you can redesign, restructure, rethink the way that you're providing services. I think that is going to be really important. And also just recognising that a lot of marginalised communities are under pressure, and expecting free labour out of them through this process to upskill you is very unreasonable. And I think that's one of the main issues, is that there hasn't been a willingness to resource, to get the expertise, to get the skills that are needed for this work.
And with moving forward, so one of the things that the government's already changing is the gun laws. Do you think that this will solve part of it?
I think it's needed. It's an important step, but it's a small step. And, you know, looking at the huge resistance that there is in some parts of the community around that, you can imagine that when we move to other more substantial things, that's where the ordinary New Zealander comes up. That's where their voice is really needed. And, you know, these days it's so easy to make a submission to a select committee inquiry. You just have to go online. You don't have to say much. You don't have to put in an expert opinion, but even a simple couple of sentences in support. If we have thousands of those, it makes a huge difference. If you can write to your MPs, if you can write to your local representatives, raising your voice to the extent that you can with the energy that you have right now and as things come up in the future is where the crucial work of ordinary New Zealanders lies.
And conversations too around hate speech have certainly accelerated. They've been around for a while, but, you know, what people were saying, trying to keep this balance between hate speech and free speech, but I think these are two very different things, right?
They are competing rights, and as with the gun laws, we saw competing rights between people that want to own whatever gun they would like for whatever recreational purposes or work purposes that they have, compared to the right of the rest of us to be safe. So as with freedom of speech and hate speech, there just hasn't been the recognition in New Zealand of the real harm that hate speech causes, and we find that in the debates around this, the voices of people that are the targets of hate speech, particularly those communities, they aren't getting the media voice that the other side is getting. We're not getting the resourcing that the other side is getting, and so there is a real dominance of one side of the debate without an equal voice on the other side of people who have been suffering violence because of hate speech. And that's not just our community. There are various other communities, and when you hear the stories of what their day-to-day lives are like, then I think people will really rethink the whole argument. But that information is just not getting out there enough, and it's being drowned out by people who aren't targeted by hate speech and so don't understand the repercussions.
I guess lastly, and it's all good if you can't actually talk about this, but you've been calling for input, I would say, into the terms of reference for the Royal Commission of Inquiry. What's happening with that now?
I understand that decisions will be made this week. We've put forward our views on that, so it's a matter of seeing whether those views are taken up in the way the final wording is on those terms of reference.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.